Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Love Babs Love Talk. Thanks for hanging out. This morning I'm delighted to have Karen Thornton of the Baldwin Project. Is that right? The Baldwin Project?
James Baldwin Project.
The James Baldwin Project. I think I've been tagging the wrong Baldwin people. Anyway, hello, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. So tell me about the James Baldwin Project, because I know you're going to be here in conversation with my dear friend and great love, Ife Gardine, for the Culturally Yes. Lit, because they're doing a year of Baldwin and has been enjoying great success with celebrating the life of James Baldwin. So when she told me she had met you, she was over the moon excited, because I guess she met you at an event and you're working on a project and you're working with the Baldwin family. And so who are you, Miss Karen Thornton? Who are you?
I'm a filmmaker. I live in Easton, Connecticut. I first started knowing who James Baldwin was from a distance when I was in college, and I took a African-American studies course and read Notes of a Native Son. And I had just come back from a junior year in France. So I really related to his questions about identity, not related to race, but because we both had left our country, were disappointed in our country and spent time in France, and we had plenty to share. But I didn't know that until fast forward to 1986. And for the next 2 years, I collaborated with James Baldwin alive. Well, he died in 87, but we connected. I found him because I had become a filmmaker since college and was working with the Maisels brothers, who were cinema verite pioneers. And they do stories following real people around, believing that a story will result. And I suggested James Baldwin, and we decided to do it. I found him. He was teaching up at UMass, and we had one incredible meeting and then worked for the next 20 months. And then all of a sudden, he fell ill, and on December 1st, 1987, he died, and a very different film was made. That's a long story, but that's kind of the overview.
And so... So you've been at this a long time. I guess you're probably considered one of the experts in all things James Baldwin.
Well, I'm one of the OGs. I really, it was a privilege, and I'm a conduit. Let's be honest here. What I did was make a film about, and he did tell me to call him Jimmy, and I will probably call him Jimmy. He'd been in love with filmmaking since he was, 10 years old, and someone at an intern who was a teacher at his school in sixth grade started taking him to the movies. And from then on, he dreamed of having his own 16mm camera, and he had a number of forays, often in front of the camera, and never quite did what he wanted. So this time he was actually deeply involved in the planning process, and we were going to do a film about Remember This House, which was a book that he was currently working on. And that book was to be about really about his friendship with Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And they went, remember in 1986 when we were doing this, he was still dealing with the assassinations that had haunted him for much of his life. And he wanted to write about them. He wanted to write about their children, whom he had known since they were infants. And really, he was close to the families. He had bounced those kids on his knees. They were now when we were working together, they were in their late teens and 20s. And so we were going to interview the children, the son of Medgar Evers, the son of Martin Luther King, the daughter of Malcolm X, and talk about progress or the lack thereof. Mm. And he was and now, excited.
I mean, we're seeing those children pass now, which is the strangest of strangest things.
I can't believe how much time has gone on and the world still hasn't solved its problems, right?
No, because humans.
Yeah, humans, because humans, exactly. Well, that brings us back to James Baldwin, because he said most of mankind is not all of mankind, and he really did see possibility. He never lost hope. He was not bitter, as some people said, but he was definitely angry, and so there are ways to translate your rage and to do something with it and to maintain hope. And that's what I learned from him. Mm-hmm. So
what do you make of this newfound interest in him now? He seems to me, Karen, so relevant, so among us, so with us. I mean, the thinking, the language, the writing is so much a part of the landscape right now. What do you make of that?
Well, some people have called him a prophet. I think he had a mind that he was an old soul, most definitely. He mm-hmm. had a sensibility that was shaped when he was young that allowed him to see the humanity in people. As he put it, he was fortunate enough to read Dickens and Dostoevsky and Henry James and a whole lot of authors before he understood the dichotomy between races. He understood the universality that human beings share. So he said, I thought I was unique in my suffering, and then I read, and then I found out that everybody has some form of suffering. So he leapt past a lot of us. And what is, I find, remarkable about him, and this is based on having watched hundreds of hours of interviews that he did over the course of his lifetime, which is how I made my film, based on archival bits and pieces. He was extraordinarily consistent. And so back to your question, even when he was out of favor, which was quite a lot. Period of years. It certainly was true when I was working with him, because he was not even being taught in the classroom. He was off the shelf. He was out of favor. He was considered a has-been. And so even despite that, he went from fame to no fame. He didn't lose his convictions. And that is, I think, part of what makes him so relevant today. He was consistent in his beliefs. He articulated it in a universal way. And when we do programs with kids who are in high school, they go, wow, this guy, he is speaking our language. It's as if he's right here with us. So mm-hmm. that's why he's so current.
Yes. Yes. But in current, but really sort of in a deep way, like not in a fad kind of way, Karen, in a real, like, he's taking his place amongst the great thinkers of our time, I think.
I don't think there's any question about that. I'm gratified to say that's true. And the sad part of it is only that more people need to rediscover him. Mm. And that's my job.
Now, what's the name of your film, Karen?
The film we made, not Remember This House, which is the one we were going to make with Jimmy. The one that I made after he died is called The Price of the Ticket, James Baldwin, The Price of the Ticket.
And you're screening it Saturday here in New Haven, well, in Hamden.
Sunday.
You're screening it Sunday. How long is this film?
It's an 87-minute film. And we call it, it's no longer cinema verite. We couldn't film Jimmy when he was alive, but we found many people all over the world who were so fascinated by him that they filmed him. And so we have pieces of Jimmy telling his own story in the first person. There's no narrator. It's James Baldwin from start to finish telling you what he thinks about what's going on. And it's very, very relevant right now, sadly. Painfully. Mm-hmm.
And so when you come across all the footage and the clips, did you have overwhelming amount of clips that you had to pare it down, or did you were like, okay, we have to stretch this out?
When he, well, I should say that when I last spoke to him, it was September of 1987, and I had heard rumors that he was ill. He wasn't broadcasting that fact. So I called him. We had many phone calls across the ocean. So I called him at where he was living in the south of France in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, and I started to ask him what I had heard about his health, and he cut right in and said, "Karen, I know why you're calling, and don't worry. We'll be filming by the end of the year." Well, I took his words at face value, but what I didn't understand is how sick he was. He died on December 1st, and we were filming by the end of the year. But what we filmed was his funeral at Saint John the Divine. And at that point, I didn't know what was out there because, as I said, he wasn't in favor. Nobody was busy broadcasting lots of clips of Baldwin. So I figured, well, that he was famous enough. There must be photographs of him hunched over a typewriter. We can have some famous friends of his read from his works. We can tell the story somehow. I wasn't quite sure. And then this is where I totally believe he's still on my shoulder, but he certainly was on my shoulder then. Stuff's just started flying in the window, amazing things from all over the world. And it was like somebody was orchestrating this who was far more powerful than I. But we had, in the long run, we ended up with 15, we had researchers in 15 different countries, and we had hundreds of hours of James Baldwin. And that collection is now with the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. But what we did is, yes, we pared it down, and it was painful. Some of it had to go. But on the other hand, there were just some amazing, just powerful insights that was Jimmy talking to us.
So tell me about the title, because I mean, listen, he's got a body of work. You could have picked anything to call this film.
We called it The Price of the Ticket, first of all, because when we completed the film just the year before, his volume of nonfiction, The Price of the Ticket, had come out. And this was a phrase in his mind that mattered. But if you read through his work, the price of life, the price of being better than we are, the price of understanding each other, the price of love, the price, he constantly talked about what it was costing us and the fact that we weren't really ready to pay it. And so it just seemed that that phrase resonated for him, and it stuck.
Oh, that is so powerful, Karen. The price, and we're not willing to pay it. The price of freedom, the price of
Yes.
liberation,
Yes.
the price of intelligence, the price of thought. Ooh,
The
that gives
price
me
of hope.
chills. The price of hope, Karen. Wow, that's pretty powerful. And all of that from this little tiny man, stat in stature, but in big
He
thought.
was tiny. When he first walked into that restaurant on the Upper West Side, the first time we met in person, that was my first thought. He looked around the room looking for me. And of course, he wasn't on time. He was always overwhelmed by doing more than he had time to do. But he walked in late and he looked around for me, and I saw him and I went, oh, he's tiny. Because for me, everything I'd read of his, he was larger than life. And then swiftly he regained his enormously huge embrace of life and became epic. So
So
he was tiny only in stature.
what did you love best about him, most about him?
Oh, well, the light that came out of his eyes, the smile that just spread across his face, and the words that came out of his mouth, he embodied, well, he walked his walk. He embodied the love that he believed would save us, and he did his best, and he was far from perfect, and he was really good at admitting that too, but he was also really funny, and he was just a delight, and it just he never ceased to provide insight and surprise and laughter. So all of the
So,
above.
do you know if he was at home in France? I mean,
Oh.
did he feel, I mean, everybody talks about why he went and he stayed, But was he at peace there? Was he happy there?
When he was at different, I mean, at different times, he wasn't in peace inside himself. So where it didn't matter where he was geographically, but when he first came down to Saint-Paul-de-Vence, he was in having a period of anxiety. He wasn't well, and he stayed across the street from this farmhouse. And eventually he learned that he stayed in Saint-Paul-de-Vence on the outskirts of the town, and he learned that the farmhouse across the street, which was run by a Franco-Algerian woman named Jeanne Faure, that she took in boarders, people who rented rooms. So he did that for a little bit, and pretty soon he and she became close friends. And she, mark this, she was an arch conservative. She'd been a pied noir, which is a Blackfoot in Algeria. She'd been forced to flee during the Franco-Algerian War because of the uprisings against the French colonial powers. She still believed in France as a colonial power. So they had these fantastic discussions
Oh, I
and
can
became
imagine. With
really, really close
a
friends.
bottle of wine. Oh my
Oh,
God.
yeah, exactly. In fact, she, this is flash. Fast forward to when he was in the last few months of his life, he was given the Legion of Honor by President Mitterrand up in Paris. And he took Jeanne Faure, his landlady, with him to receive the Medal of Honor. He was given it the same time as Leonard Bernstein, the Legion of Honor. Anyway, that shows you how, and he marched, he was chosen by her family to lead the funeral procession, which in Saint-Paul-de-Vence when she died. So it shows you how he was able to see past people's partisan failings and human failings to embrace what was best in them
That's
and
a real
become.
skill.
Yes. And so he ended up buying the house. The house was lost through various shenanigans and legal battles. But to answer your question, he found peace there and he found friends there and he had extraordinary, I think, close to 17 years. I've lost track of time, but he was there a long time. And he'd retreat to there to finish his work, as well as in Istanbul in Turkey. He had two havens where he went to solve his, he didn't have writer's block, but he had to wrestle with his characters.
So do you know if he ever was ever in love, Karen?
Oh, very much so.
Because we
The
don't
book.
hear about that. We don't hear about if he was in love or what love looked like with him. I don't hear
I
that.
think it was a confusing issue for him because he was openly homosexual, as he told us in his first, his second novel, Giovanni's Room. As he put it, a news broadcaster asked him, why did he write that? And he said, well, I didn't want to be blackmailed. I didn't want to, I told you didn't tell me. So he was openly homosexual. And it was confusing to him because of the way the world treats that. But he also was early on in his teenage and early 20 years, he fell in love with a number of women and he understood the possibility of love. And to quote him, he said, love comes in strange packages. I've loved a few men and I've loved a few women, and that's really all that saved my life. So a couple of times he nearly married. He even bought an engagement ring once, but he threw it away. His great love, the love of his life, was a Swiss, young Swiss boy whom he met at the age of 17 when he was in Paris. Lucien Happersberger was 17. Jimmy was 24. And they spent all their days and nights together. And that Lucien, even though Lucien went on to marry a woman, have some kids and different stories in his life, they stayed in touch forever at different times. Lucien was Jimmy's personal secretary. And I think Jim, if anyone, Jimmy loved Lucien all of his life. And they just went through different forms of what that relationship would, you know, the shape of it changed. But Lucien was there at Jimmy's bedside when he died.
Wow. So tell me about the family. How did they receive you coming to them saying, "You know what? I'd like to do this film, and it's going to be a film celebrating him or showing him. Like it's not going to be a film where, I'm trying to harm his character. I'm just, you know, what was that like to talk with the family initially?
I didn't get to say much of that. You would have persuaded them much better than I. What really happened is that Jimmy's best friend was his brother David, who was 10 years younger, and David Baldwin and James Baldwin were together both in France, in Turkey, throughout the States, and David knew that Jimmy and I were working on the project. So when Jimmy died, I heard about it from a friend who was listening to NPR, who called me and said, "Did you know James Baldwin died last night?" And this was 7 in the morning, and he died the night before, and it was on the radio. And so I was totally shocked, because as I said, I didn't know that he was that sick. I didn't expect it. So then I next reached out to his brother David, and I saw David the night before his funeral at St. John the Divine. He was in a funeral home, and the casket was open, casket was laid out in the funeral home, and people were lined up around the block. And so what I had decided in the 10 days between his death, and I guess 8 days between his death and the funeral, was that a film should be made, and that I got 3 camera people together in hopes that we'd be able to film at St. John the Divine. But the family was just beset by all kinds of press people who were, you know, trying to, paparazzi types, and mm-hmm. they didn't want any coverage. But I stood in line at the funeral home, went through the line, and then David and other family members were greeting people at the end of this procession inside the funeral home. And David recognized me, and he said, "Karen, you can do this." And that was as simple as that. I now have 3 stones that David gave me, which basically is my contract with the family. They were 3 beautiful rounded stones that Jimmy had picked up on the beach in the south of France. And so David had a collection of those, and I have those stones with me still. But that was how we came to that agreement. Mm. And indeed, we did film the funeral the next day.
Really?
At St. John the Divine.
Oh. And there are descendants of the Baldwin family among us. Like, they're still younger Baldwins alive and well.
A lot of nieces and nephews. Not Trevor Baldwin lives in New York. A number of members live in Washington, D.C. Some cousins are in Baltimore, where Jimmy's mother came from. One of his nephews lives in Paris. They're all over the world, and they're wonderful people, and they each are individuals who have been obviously shaped by their life as Jimmy never had his own kids, even though he was in love. That was one of the holes in his life. And so his nieces and nephews were extraordinarily important to him. And every time he was interviewed, when he talked about progress, he's, "What am I going to tell my nieces and nephews?" He cared as much as the kids of Martin and Malcolm and Medgar. He cared about youth in general, and his nieces and nephews were at the top of the list. He wanted a better world for them, and he believed it was possible.
Hmm. So you worked on this film, you create the film, you do it with the blessings of the Baldwin family and the Baldwin estate. So what do you want people to take away from this film? When you put it out into the world, you send it out into the world, what do you hope that will happen when people experience it?
Well, usually they are surprised, and their understanding is expanded. And my hope is that it helps them embrace the same message that James Baldwin lived by, because he delivers it on camera, and you can judge him and you see him as a human being, I believe. You don't see him as some kind of saint who's out of reach. He has something to say. I hope it drives people to the books, and I hope it helps them in their relationships with each other. And I hope it helps them to see human beings with empathy and understanding. And I also hope it gives them one thing that people talk about after seeing the film, is how to express their rage, not just their sorrow. Mm. And there's cause for anger. And Jimmy was good at expressing his anger. And usually there are moments in the film when people burst into applause because he voices his anger, and we still need to do that. So I guess this is, we hope it's one of the ingredients that people take to heart as one way to help change the world, because it sure needs evolving.
So what do you do after you put this film out? And do you work on more companion James Baldwin stuff, or do you feel satisfied that you've honored your friend?
Well, first of all, I didn't have any idea. It was like being swept up on a wave. I became a conduit for stuff for a few years. We traveled all over the world because everybody wanted to show this film in film festivals and in different countries on TV. And that lasted for a couple of years. And then I did go back to being a filmmaker of on other topics. And I do like the intersection of art and social justice, and have worked on a film. I made a film with Tracy Holder, co-director of on Joe Papp, the man who founded the public theater. And
yes.
Worked on a film, worked on a whole bunch of stuff. A lot of our work, I work with my husband, Douglas Dempsey, and our work is in various institutions on the National Mall. But what really happened in 2013, Martin Scorsese, who knew of the film, was making a film on Fran Lebowitz for HBO, and Fran named James Baldwin as one of her mentors, the inspiring people in her life. So he called me up and said, could I take a piece of your film to use in my film about Fran Lebowitz? And I said, sure, I'll send you a video master. And he said, no, I know you shot on 16 millimeter. I want to go back to the negative. And so he's a film preservationist.
That's real. That's good. I was going to say, real filmmaker, real preservationist. Yes.
Yes. And so what we did is we got the negative up from the basement of the laboratory where it was stored, and lo and behold, there'd been the tape wasn't properly affixed to the can, and the negative had some damage. And so he said, hey, if you don't start restoring this film right now, you're going to lose it forever. So suddenly I dropped my project on Thomas Paine and pivoted to James Baldwin restoration, raised the money. Boy, is it expensive to restore a film. And
I thought Martin Scorsese was like raising money so that they could preserve films and stuff.
Yes, and a number of people, all kinds of individuals, including the Ford Foundation, which helped in a big way, helped us raise the money. We're still paying the bill, I have to say, but by 2015, we had a digital Baldwin, an 87-minute version that we could show. And having put all this effort into it, and Jimmy's 90th birthday was upon us, it suddenly occurred to me that, look, I think we need to get this out there. So I started this thing called Conversations with Jimmy. And long story short, we ended up reaching tens of thousands of people. It became a nationwide effort. We took the film everywhere. And since then, it just hasn't stopped. So I ended up really, now I have become an official conduit. This is what I do.
Well, how could you not? I mean,
I it's really, this is my form of reparations, if you will, I say humbly, because I found that this actually could make a difference. And so it was making more of a difference than anything else I was doing. So what we're doing now is celebrating James Baldwin's centennial. And we have programs already committed all over the country. And we started in January at the Film Forum in New York City, and happily had a sellout crowd. And they did a whole series on James Baldwin. There are at least six films that are out there of various lengths. So including Ralph Peck's I Am Not Your Negro, and I Heard It Through the Grapevine, and just so many, Pat Hartley's film, Dick Fontaine's film is Grapevine, and Sadat Paquet's From Another Place. There are just some wonderful films also made in the UK and in France, various places. So there are ways to see James Baldwin now, but again, we need to draw attention to it to get people in the door and to have them go, wow, I didn't know who this guy was. I never understood. Or people say, I thought he was just so angry. All this love is kind of amazing. You know, people are discovering him in different ways. So,
I love that.
yeah, but what we ended up doing is choosing a theme for his centennial, all this outreach, all this programming, and the what we call it is James Baldwin Centennial Identity, comma, Then and Now. And it's really an exploration of identity. And it's what got me interested in him way back when I was in college. I was struggling with my identity as an American and as a female and as a would be, I wanted to be a writer at that time. So all of the reasons that I connected with him, I gradually began to think about race as well. But that identity covers so many, oh, it's a wide embrace too. So we
Wide,
talk about identity in our programs, and the after doing the opening of the centennial year at the Film Forum, we did a number of programs, and the next one coming up, as you said, is in New Haven at Best Video in Hamden, and April 7th. And Ife, Michelle, and I will be talking to the crowd and telling stories after the film is over. So
yes.
we hope we have a good crowd, and then we're going to be doing something on April 24th at the New Haven Public Library as well. A spoken word performance called James Baldwin Out Loud, where it's a three-way conversation between a white actor, a black actor, and James Baldwin on screen,
I
and
love it.
somewhere between a dance and a sermon.
I love that, you know what, that in this modern, very modern time, that people are reimagining, or not so much reimagining, but centering James Baldwin in these modern times. Like I think that's the ultimate kiss right there, I think.
Kiss is a good word.
Okay, I
We need that. We also have
kiss.
some social identity workshops that we've created that we're taking into schools, where we have different Baldwin quotes that make people think about who they are. And this applies to people who are in the world of LGBTQ plus and to immigrants and to people who are simply unsure of who they want to be. Identity, it matters. Michelle Norris, who was a broadcaster on NPR, has written a book about identity. And she had a challenge where she had everybody come up with six words about identity. And she has now an entire book full. I mean, thousands and thousands of people contributed. But I decided, okay, what would James Baldwin's six words be? And I came up with not what I am, but who.
I like
So
that. That sounds apropos. I would co-sign that. I would. I
anyway,
would.
I ask all our viewers or listeners to come up with their own phrases and ponder their own identity. And if they have a community where they'd like to show our film, let us know. We're going on. We have a grant from Connecticut Humanities that allows us to go across the state of Connecticut, and we're hoping to get grants that'll take us across the country. And
Okay.
luckily,
Well,
the one thing people need to know about a centennial is it doesn't quite quit with one year, because
no.
we have 100 years after James Baldwin was born in 1924, so this is the 100th year since his birth. But he didn't turn one until this coming August, and he won't turn 100. I mean, next in 2025, he will turn 100. So we have that year. And then if we're still going, we've got the 250th anniversary of this country, which I think owes James Baldwin a little bit of patriotism.
I think you're
So
absolutely right.
I hope we're still screening the film then.
Karen, it was a pleasure talking to you. I'm so glad I got this opportunity. I cannot wait to see your film, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
I do as well. To be continued.
Yes, to be continued. Thank you so much, Karen Thornton, from the James Baldwin Project.
Look
And
at our
y'all.
website, www.jamesbaldwinproject.org.
.org and come out Sunday to Best
Please.
Video to see the film and to see Karen and Ife in conversation as a talk back. So Thank you, Karen. Enjoy the rest of your week until I see you on Sunday.
I look forward to it, Babs.
Thank you.
Bye
Thank you,
bye.
Harry Droz. We're on our way out. I'll be back tomorrow, good people. Y'all stay dry. I'll see y'all.